Well, we're in the final unit, just three more chapters, and the first of those, which we're starting right now, is about meiosis and sexual life cycles. We've already talked about mitosis, but we're gonna talk about meiosis in this chapter soon. First, though, let's just talk about this opening slide, which gives two examples of representatives of the two types of reproduction that we find in biology. There's asexual reproduction and there is sexual reproduction. Obviously, they're opposites of each other. And obviously, there are differences between the two. It's not correct, though, to say that one is better than the other. There's advantages and disadvantages to both. But the huge difference is that asexual reproduction involves just one parent that creates some number of offspring by itself. And those offspring, if they're created, are genetically identical to the parent, unless mistakes occur, which would be mutation, of course. Sexual reproduction, on the other hand, involves two parents. Now, the parents, the organisms, those individuals, don't necessarily ever have to meet each other, but it involves two parents, each of which produce sex cells or gametes. And it's those gametes, at least, that have to come together. And if that happens, then sexual reproduction produces some number of offspring that are not only genetically distinct from both parents, they're not identical to either parent, they're also not, the offspring aren't genetically identical to each other. And that is really the most important difference between the two. Sexual reproduction involves a shuffling of the genetic deck, in a sense. It creates new genetic combinations, new genetic sequences, new DNA sequences. And since we've already studied DNA, that means new sets of traits occur because of sexual reproduction. Now, just for these examples, we have a hydra, which is a protist. So it's a eukaryote that is, in this case, unicellular. Hydras are not unicellular, but they're microscopic. They're very small. It produces by an asexual technique called budding. You can see a bud kind of sprouting out of its side. And eventually, it will detach and become its own individual. And like I said, that offspring, that bud, will be genetically identical to the parent. On the other hand, a redwood is, of course, a plant. Plants and animals and a lot of other eukaryotes reproduce sexually. Some organisms, including some plants, can do either asexual or sexual reproduction. Now, what would be a situation in which there would be an advantage to asexual reproduction? Well, except that mates doesn't make any sense for an asexual reproducer. There aren't any such.
Oh, and are there like that sharks can dig into parthenogenesis?
Yeah, but I'm talking about for a species that has no choice.
Oh.
It's changing the environment.
What was that?
It's changing the environment.
Is an advantage for asexual reproduction?
Their advantage is that they would be able to, it's asexual, they'd be able to, trying to use the word, adapt to their environment.
Actually, just the opposite.
Oh.
That's the advantage for sex.
Is it because
they're gotcha. Asexual reproduction produces identical offspring, right? Mm-hmm. Which means the offspring are going to be exactly like the parents. Well, if the parent is well adapted to the surroundings in which it lives, then why would you want to do anything other than to make an exact copy of yourself, right? Because that's going to guarantee that your offspring are also just as fit as you are, right? So that's an advantage. So a non-changing environment would be an ideal situation for an asexual reproducer. The problem, of course, is that real environments are never permanently unchanging. They eventually change. And therefore, what is well adapted for an environment is suddenly not a well adapted situation if the environment changes. And that's why sex has been accepted evolutionarily. It's why it has worked by natural selection. Because as environments change, sex produces offspring that... It's pretty much a crapshoot what you get with sex for the offspring. Some of them aren't going to be as well adapted as you, the parent, are. But some of them might randomly be even better adapted for a new environment that you're not adapted to because it's changing. All right? So that's the huge advantage of sex. Let's go to 2 and look at this photograph with the black background. This is an example of what's called a karyotype. Same root as in eukaryote and prokaryote. Remember, in that sense, karyo meaning kernel refers to the nucleus of the cell. Well, a karyotype is a photograph, just like you see here, of a cell of... it's a photograph of the chromosomes found in the cell of a eukaryotic organism. But it's more than just that. Notice how orderly this is. These chromosomes don't pose for the photograph. It's a real, they're real pictures, but obviously they don't line up like this. So this is a cut and paste job. And nowadays cut and paste we think of electronically, but the original karyotypes were literally cut and paste. You take a photograph of the cell through a microscope, and wherever those chromosomes are, after you print the photograph on photographic paper, you actually cut out each one and then arrange them by size, pair them up like you see here, and then take another picture of that pasted set of chromosome pictures. That's a karyotype. Now, of course, we can do it electronically. But a karyotype is an orderly arrangement of chromosomes found in a eukaryotic cell. And notice the numbers, which, of course, are not in the cell. We have the numbers. The numbers refer to types of chromosomes, different types of chromosomes in the same cell, and they are ordered by size. Number 1 includes the largest type of chromosome, 2 the second largest, and so on. This happens to be a karyotype for a human. And there are 23 kinds of chromosomes in a human. There's no number 23 for reasons I'll get into in a minute, but there are 23 types. What would be 23 is just called X and Y in this case. It could be XX in another case. But that's what the numbering means, size. All right? calling these different types of chromosomes refers to the fact that the genes, which remember are the DNA, part of the DNA, the genes that are in chromosome number one correspond or control indirectly characteristics that are totally different from the characteristics that are controlled by the genes on any of the other chromosomes, two and above. That's what makes them different types of chromosomes. Not only are they different sizes and contain different amounts of genes, but those genes are totally different in as far as what they control.
All right.
Now, when you produce a karyotype, you want to get a shot of, you want to get the best shot possible. So what part of the cell cycle do you think a karyotype photograph is made in? When are the chromosomes maximally different from each other?
Metaphase.
Distinct from each other. Yeah, metaphase. Because metaphase is when there is the maximal condensing of chromatin. They are the small as they're ever going to be, and therefore they're easiest as they're ever going to be to tell from all the other chromosomes, tell apart from all the other chromosomes. So yes, metaphase. Now, just one of these, the number one chromosome in the white box here, is shown in cartoon form in detail on the left. And I don't want you to think make the mistake between what we're seeing here and what we've looked at before when we first started talking about sister chromatids, because that was kind of an X shape. It's two sister chromatids connected together at a centromere, kind of makes an X shape, right? This X shape is not a replicated chromosome. This is two replicated chromosomes. There are two chromosome number ones here, and they're not identical to each other. The one on the left is a replicated chromosome in its own right, consisting of two sister chromatids that are identical to each other, held together at a centromere. The right part of the X is another replicated chromosome number one, also consisting of two sister chromatids identical to each other. But the sister chromatids in the left half of this pair are not genetically identical to the sister chromatids in the right half. The same cell has two number ones and two number twos and so on. Now, why does it have two? Well, even more generally than that, having to do with what we just talked about in slide one. This is a human we're looking at. Right, humans, animals in general, and a lot of other groups of eukaryotes as well, reproduce sexually. That means they have two parents, each of which pass on chromosomes to their offspring. That's why there's two of each type of chromosome in a human cell, one from the mother and one from the father. That's also why they're not identical to each other. The two number ones are not identical to each other because your mother is not identical to your father. It's the same set of genes that control the same set of characteristics, but it's not necessarily the same DNA. There are stretches, of course, that will be the same, but the whole thing is not identical. Okay, so since these are both number ones, that's a special relationship. They're the same type of chromosome, just from different parents originally. And therefore, we call them homologous chromosomes. This is a homologous pair of chromosomes. And the overall karyotype has 23 homologous pairs of chromosomes. Because for our species, there are 23 different kinds of chromosomes. That number is different for all other species. But for humans, it's 23. Okay, let's go to 3 now and talk more about numbers of chromosomes. There's different ways that we describe numbers of chromosomes, and this can be confusing. What I just said about humans, namely that we have 23 different kinds of chromosomes, that gets a special symbol in biology for any given species. The number of different kinds of chromosomes that a species has is denoted by N. The symbol N means the number of different kinds of chromosomes. Okay? So N for humans, N's a variable obviously, but N for humans is specifically 23. For corn, N is 40. And different species have different N numbers. Okay? But that's what N always means, the number of different kinds. Now, that's one way of talking about how many chromosomes there are. Another is what we call ploidy. This is a general word because there are different degrees of ploidy. Okay, but ploidy does not mean how many different kinds of chromosomes there are. That's N, as I just said. Ploidy is how many of each kind of chromosome are there in a cell. In other words, how many number ones are there, how many number twos, and so on. That's ploidy. And even though there's more than two possibilities, there are two main possibilities in biology, one of which is that there is two of each, just like in the human karyotype we looked at in the previous slide. There were two number ones and two of each, right? So the ploidy specifically, in the case of having two of each, is diploidy. That's the condition, or we call the cell diploid, if it is true that that cell contains two of each kind, however many there are. However many kinds there are, I mean. But if there's two of each, two of each kind, then it's a diploid cell. If, on the other hand, there's only one of each of the N different kinds, then that is a haploid cell. The karyotype we just looked at was a diploid karyotype. Okay? Now, let's look at this fictitious cell. This is a specific example. And the answers are here, but make sense of it in your mind. Don't just read the answers. How many different kinds of chromosomes are here in this cell? No. I mean specifically, don't use a variable. Just look at the picture and tell me how many different kinds of chromosomes there are. Yes, there are three. Think of it as a big one, a medium one, and a small one. Those are the different kinds of chromosomes, with different collections of genes that correspond to different collections of characteristics. Okay? Okay, so that's where N equals 3 comes from. For this particular species, whatever it is, there are three different kinds of chromosomes, and therefore N equals 3 because N always means that. The number of different kinds of chromosomes the species has. Okay, it's 3 in this case, 23 for us. Notice that every one of these chromosomes, by the way, is replicated. Each one consists of two sister chromatids. That's why each one looks like it's doubled. It is doubled, right? But notice there aren't 3 chromosomes here total. There's 6 chromosomes here. And that's because there's 2 big ones, 2 medium ones, and 2 small ones. In other words, there's 2 of each of the 3 kinds. Well, ploidy, as I said, is how many of each kind there are. The answer to that question, how many of each kind, is 2 in this case, right? There's a red and a blue big one, a red and a blue medium one, a red and a blue small one. So the ploidy, specifically for this cell, is diploidy. This is a diploid cell. Is that clear to you? And now, why do we have the different colors? What does that mean? Right, as it says. But what does that mean?
It means that whatever organisms came from is reproduces sexually.
Right, that's why it's diploid. Sexual species feature diploidy because two parents donate chromosomes and therefore offspring have chromosomes from each of two parents. They have two of every kind. And so in this cartoon, the blue simply means that's the chromosome that happened to come from the father, which is what paternal means, and the red one came from the mother. Okay, so make sense of the difference between N and ploidy. They're totally different ways of counting chromosomes. Now, N itself has a specific value that depends on the species, of course. But when we just write N by itself, that also can be called the haploid number. Because if a cell has N total chromosomes, that means it must only have one of each of the N types, right? N is one N, mathematically. This cell does not have N chromosomes, it has two N chromosomes. So 2N as a symbol is also special. 2N always denotes the diploid number for that species. Any questions on any of those definitions? All right. Well, let's then talk about sexual life cycles, starting at slide 4. This one uses humans as an example, just because you're most familiar with humans. But really what we see here, as we'll see in the next slide, applies to all animals, not just humans. Actually, what we see here applies to all sexual species. But anyway, we'll get to the next slide after this one. The important point that I was just referring to by saying that even though this is a human example, it applies to all sexual species, is that all sexually reproducing species feature a generation-to-generation alternation between two processes. Meaning, and I'm not talking about within the lifetime of an individual. By generation-to-generation, I mean from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next. Okay? And alternation means you're going back and forth between two processes as you go from generation to generation. And those two processes are shown in the boxes here, meiosis and fertilization. So, for any given sexual species, it's back and forth between fertilization, then meiosis, then fertilization, then meiosis, and so on. It's important to define both of these terms, starting with fertilization. Fertilization is the defining event in sexual reproduction. In other words, without fertilization, you don't have sexual reproduction. Fertilization is what defines sexual reproduction. But what is fertilization? Well, fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce one unicellular zygote. Makes sense that it's going to produce one because I just told you it's fusion. Two cells come together, which is kind of an exception to cell theory, right? Usually, one cell splits into two. In sexual reproduction, you have two cells fusing into one. Gametes, once again, is a general term. This is the unisex term for sex cells. The male, and depending on species, these can have different names, but for most animals, for instance, the male gametes are the sperm and the female gametes are the eggs. And not only animals, a bunch of other things too. It's called that for plants as well. But anyway, gametes means is the unisex version. It could mean either one of those two. All right, well, each gamete from each parent is a single-celled carrier of chromosomes. And therefore, when the two types of gametes fuse into one cell, that means that zygote, which is the name for the one cell that results, is going to now have chromosomes from both of those gametes. So, just knowing that is true, it should make sense to you that a zygote has double the ploidy compared to a gamete, based on the definition of ploidy, right? The ploidy is how many of each type there are. Well, an egg and a sperm get together to form a zygote. Now the zygote has chromosomes from each of from that parent and from the other parent. And therefore, there's twice as many of each type of chromosome in the zygote than there were in either of the gametes. The ploidy has doubled. That has to happen for sex to occur, for sexual reproduction to occur, for fertilization to occur. Right? That's the only way you're going to get contribution, genetic contribution from each of two parents, is if you're bringing chromosomes from each of those parents together into one cell. So we've talked about the advantage of sex that creates new genetic combinations, but it also presents a problem because it doubles the ploidy. Therefore, if you only had fertilization occurring in each generation, that means each generation would have double the ploidy compared to the previous generation. Right? You'd get two haploids together to form a diploid zygote, and then two diploids would get together to form a tetraploid, and then an octuploid in the next generation. That would quickly become impossible. There just is not any room in a cell. It's already amazing how much DNA we pack into an invisible nucleus within an invisible cell, right? We can't afford to double it indefinitely. So that would cause the extinction of all sexual species. Well, that hasn't happened, obviously. We're successful. But that means we need to have some other process that takes, that relieves that problem. The doubling. Fertilization doubles the ploidy. Therefore, to avoid an actual doubling every generation, each generation you also have to have a process that cuts it in half so that overall it doesn't accumulate. Okay? Doubling occurs, and then halving undoes that doubling. So you're back to where you started with. Well, that other process that halves, or cuts in half, the ploidy is meiosis. That's why meiosis exists. Okay? And so, for us humans, our gametes are haploid. An egg and a sperm, each haploid, carrying one of each of the 23, get together to form a zygote that is diploid. It's carrying two of each of the 23 chromosomes now. All right. And then by mitosis, that's going to become a multicellular adult human, which at sexual maturity will be able, through meiosis, to create haploid gametes of his or her own. Okay, so meiosis starts as a diploid cell but creates haploid cells, and in the next generation they can get together to form another diploid zygote and so on over and over. Yeah.
So we spoke about, you know, cancer won't stop, so it metastasizes. How
right.
does that occur if it does occur with fertilization, like how people have like 22 or like one less extra chromosome, how does that work?
Well, if you have one fewer chromosome, is a much bigger deal than one too many.
Okay.
Both of those are abnormalities that actually I'm going to get into in a different place. So I'll just save it till then.
Okay.
Because we're going to talk about it anyway. Let's first, though, talk about how things happen normally. Okay, now, the fact that there is, I mean, in addition to the fact that there are these two processes occurring within the life cycle of any sexual species, meiosis and fertilization happens in any sexual species, it's also true that any sexual life cycle features a haploid stage and a diploid stage. All right? In this case, the haploid stage is the cyan-colored one. That, for us humans, is the gametes. The gametes are haploid. Now, each gamete, each sexual species really has two versions of the species, a haploid version and a diploid version. We tend to think that the diploid version is the only thing that's human. Well, that's not true. Our bodies are diploid humans, but there's a different version of humans called haploid humans. Our gametes are unicellular versions of humans. A sperm is a unicellular haploid human. An egg is a unicellular haploid human. They don't live nearly as long as we multicellular humans do, but they are humans. And similarly for other species. They don't live very long because either they will die soon if they don't engage in fertilization, if they don't unite with a gamete of the opposite type, or they will no longer exist because once fertilization happens, the gametes are no longer there, right? They now become a new cell, the zygote, which begins another round of the diploid stage. Okay? That's true not just for us, that's true for sexual species in general. So let's look at slide 5, which shows you three similar-looking life cycles, but for three major groups of organisms, or three major groups of eukaryotes. Animals on the left, and this is identical to the one we just looked at because humans are animals, and this is true for all animals. Okay? We also have plants in the middle and fungi on the right. Every one of them shares what I've told you is true of all sexual species. Every sexual life cycle features an alternation between fertilization and meiosis. And also every sexual life cycle features part of the life cycle that is only half the ploidy compared to the other part. Okay, the green or the seafoam color and the brownish color. There are differences, obviously, though, otherwise we wouldn't list all these. So for animals in general, which we're, of course, part of, the diploid stage dominates. That's most of the time of the sexual life cycle. Okay, that's we live our lives, we animals live our lives individually as diploid organisms. The haploid organisms are the eggs and the sperm that live unicellular lives, much shorter. And the reason that we are multicellular is that we start out as a single cell, the zygote. That happens by definition at fertilization. But that zygote, which is diploid because of fertilization doubling the ploidy, undergoes mitosis to become a multicellular diploid human. Right, that's how you grew. Meiosis, then, in sexually mature diploid multicellular animals, produces haploid gametes. Let's look at the other extreme on the right before we look at the middle. This is most fungi. Because, in a sense, they're kind of the opposite of us animals. They still have a haploid and a diploid stage, like we do, but it's reversed as to which is dominant. For most fungi, the haploid stage dominates over the diploid stage. What I mean by that is that a typical fungus, you know, when you look at the individual, its body is made up of haploid cells. Now, since a fungus's body is made up of haploid cells, when it comes time for that fungus to make gametes, which need to be haploid, you don't do that via meiosis. You do it by mitosis, because mitosis makes cells that are identical to the original cells. If a cell is already haploid and you need haploid cells, you use mitosis to make more haploid cells. Okay? When gametes produced by two individual fungi get together through fertilization, it happens the same way as it does for us. That doubles the ploidy, right? That produces a diploid zygote. But unlike us, this diploid zygote doesn't undergo mitosis to become multicellular diploid. The zygote, which is diploid, undergoes, while it's still just one cell, undergoes meiosis, cutting the ploidy in half to produce haploid cells, spores, which then that's the beginning of multiple individual offspring. Each spore is a unicellular haploid fungus, and each one then undergoes mitosis to become a multicellular adult fungus, haploid. You see the difference? Now, what animals and fungi share, even though they're kind of opposites of each other as far as which stage dominates, is that there is multicellularity in only one of the two stages of the life cycle. For animals, the diploid stage is multicellular. The haploid stage is unicellular only. Just the opposite for fungi, but there's still only one multicellular stage. In a fungus, it's the haploid stage that's multicellular, and the diploid stage is only ever unicellular. Does that make sense, based on the definitions? Okay, now let's go to the middle, which is plants. Go ahead.
So for mushrooms, the fruiting body of it, it's after meiosis then, right?
Yeah, meiosis only creates an invisible single cell, which is a new fungus, mm-hmm. and it becomes multicellular by mitosis, keeping it haploid.
Okay, got it.
And so the fruiting body that you see is creating gametes that are also haploid, but they're going to get together with gametes from another haploid individual to produce a diploid zygote, which is then going to undergo mitosis to produce new spores, creating new individuals. Now we're in the middle, though, plants. And this one is a little bit different. Plants have what is called an alternation of generations, which is kind of a confusing term because I've already used this word alternation. Alternation of generations does not refer to what all sexual species have. This alternation between fertilization and meiosis that I mentioned, that's for all sexual species, not just plants. Plants have an alternation of generations, which is really should more specifically be called an alternation of diploid generations. It's just we have shortened the phrase. What it refers to is that in plants, both the haploid and the diploid stage features multicellularity, unlike us and unlike fungi. Okay, so just like us and fungi, there's two versions of the species, a haploid version and a diploid version. But they're both multicellular. And so you can see these little cartoons. In some groups of plants, the ones that got started when plants were a new group, these they're still species that exist. Anyway, they look like totally different species because they're both multicellular. They're big enough to see with the naked eye, but they look totally different even though they're the same species because one is haploid and one is diploid. All right? Well, the haploid version, the green part of the plant's life cycle, those are called gametophytes. Now, just phyte by itself, P-H-Y-T-E, means plant. So gametophytes are named for the fact that they are the version of the plant species that produces gametes. They're haploid. They produce gametes by mitosis, just like haploid fungi do. The diploid multicellular stage is called the sporophyte generation. Spore-producing plants. And the sporophytes are diploid, so when they need to produce gametes, they do so by meiosis. Right? Because they're diploid, they need to make haploid gametes, just like we do. Yes, and sporophytes are diploid. Okay, so that's the big difference. Both the haploid and the diploid part of a plant's sexual life cycle is multicellular. For us animals, only the diploid stage is multicellular. For most fungi, only the haploid stage is multicellular. They produce gametes just like, or I mean, they produce spores, they're called, but they operate just like our.
And they do that through mitosis?
Through meiosis. Oh, because you have to get to haploid. Mm-hmm. The spores have to be haploid. You're starting with a diploid cell from a sporophyte, because sporophytes are diploid, so you need a mechanism that reduces the ploidy in half. Just like we do when we produce our gametes. Okay, now it's time to talk about the specifics of meiosis. Meiosis is not only a similar word to mitosis, but it's also similar in what happens compared to mitosis. So I need you to often think back to mitosis that you've already learned about and compare it in your mind, make sense of important similarities and differences between that, the process you already know about, mitosis, and the one that we're talking about now, which is meiosis. First of all, one thing that they have in common is that they are both nuclear divisions, right? Mitosis, as you've already learned, is division of the nucleus. Well, so is meiosis, but for a different reason. Mitosis always produces genetically identical cells. It makes copies of whatever starts the process of mitosis. Well, assuming cytokinesis also happens, right? So this is how we become multicellular. It doesn't change our genetics. All of the cells that are created from that original zygote have the same chromosomes because mitosis makes exact copies. Meiosis doesn't, for a few reasons that we'll talk about. But before we get into this slide 6, what's specifically shown in slide 6, let me tell you that in a multicellular organism, there are two major categories of cells. So this applies to your own body, for instance. You're a multicellular organism. Two major categories of cells, which are called somatic cells and germline cells. Now, somatic cells is a bit of a misnomer because somatic means of the body. Well, all of the cells are part of the body, and therefore it doesn't really make sense to call just some of them somatic cells. But the reason that the name kind of makes sense is that by far, almost all of those cells that make up the multicellular individual are somatic cells. So what you call your body is almost entirely somatic cells. The germline cells is a tiny, tiny fraction of your overall cells, and those occur only in gonads. This is another unisex term. Gonads are organs that produce gametes. So for two sexes, there's two versions of gonads. Female gonads are ovaries, which are egg-producing structures. That's the one kind of gamete. Male gonads are testes, which produce sperm, the other kind of gamete. Okay, now, that's the two categories, so obviously there must be differences between them. But the difference is not in ploidy. Germline cells and somatic cells are both diploid cells. So that's not the difference that distinguishes these two categories. What's different is the kind of cell division, specifically nuclear division, that these two categories of cells can undergo. Somatic cells, if they do divide their nuclei, can do so only by mitosis. So a somatic cell either never divides or divides by mitosis and cytokinesis and therefore produces genetically identical cells. When you produce genetically identical cells, that means whatever the ploidy is originally, that's what the ploidy of the two new cells is. Genetically identical in every way. Okay, germline cells, on the other hand, divide first by mitosis, and then those cells that are produced by mitosis can undergo meiosis. And meiosis, as we've already talked about, cuts the ploidy in half. Well, that's what you want if you're producing a gamete, right? You want gametes to be haploid so that when you get two gametes together, you're making only a diploid zygote and not a tetraploid one. So that's why meiosis exists to take care of this doubling problem we talked about. But since that's true, why not just undergo meiosis to begin with? Why undergo mitosis first? Well, the answer is something I've already told you. The vast majority of your cells are somatic cells. In terms of number, you have a very, very tiny population of germline cells. If germline cells were allowed to undergo only meiosis, then every time that happened, you would be losing an additional germline cell, right? You already have a tiny number of them. If it undergoes meiosis, that original cell is no longer there. You now have two gametes in its place. And therefore, this already small population would become depleted to nothing. So what happens in a germline cell, which is diploid, is that it undergoes mitosis first. That produces two identical diploid cells, right? One of those is going to hang around to replace the one that you just lost, and the other one is going to go through meiosis to produce gametes. And that way you maintain this small population of germline cells. Okay, now let's talk about the particulars of six. Looking at this picture on the top, that single cell, whatever species this represents, what is N? N is one. Does everyone agree? There's only one kind of chromosome here, one size. And what's the ploidy? Ploidy, we use a word, not a number.
N.
No. N is a totally different thing. What?
Diploid.
It's a diploid cell because there are two of every kind. There's only one kind, but there's two of that kind. So it's diploid. Okay. And this is a lie at the top because you would not really see these as chromosomes yet. Right? You don't see them condense as chromosomes until after it has gone through the S phase where it doubles the number of genetic... It doubles the chromatin, right? So on this bottom one, this is not a lie. Or not the bottom one, the middle one. The one below it. This has the same ploidy, right? It's still diploid. Has the same N, one. But each of these chromosomes is now replicated because it has gone through the S phase of interphase. Everyone understand what I'm saying about this one being a lie? You wouldn't see chromosomes in the S phase. It would just be diffuse chromatin. But that chromatin then replicates, and then by the time it gets through G2 and it's in the M phase, which in this case would be for meiosis, not for mitosis, because this is a germline cell, then the chromosomes that are condensed and easily distinguishable from each other are already replicated. So each one consists of two identical sister chromatids. But the blue chromatids are not identical to the red chromatids, even though they're the same type of chromosome, because they have different parental origin, right? One came from the mother, one came from the father. Is that all clear? Okay. Now, one huge difference between meiosis and mitosis is that unlike mitosis, which involves only one division event, meiosis involves two division events. And therefore, the overall process of meiosis is broken into what we call meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 with Roman numerals. Each one features a splitting event. Now, here's what most students struggle with when they're first learning meiosis, so listen carefully. And here's where you need to already have a mastery of mitosis to understand meiosis. So first, let's think. Don't look at this picture. Just think back to mitosis. In mitosis, of course, there's different subphases, but in metaphase, what happens? No, that's when they line up. Metaphase involves a lining up. As we'll see, meiosis has the same named subphases, but different things are happening. Well, in metaphase of mitosis, and let's assume we're talking about a diploid cell for mitosis, okay? What is it that lines up in metaphase during mitosis? Well, yes, but you have to be more specific. Not individually, no. Well, that's what a chromosome is. But what lines up during metaphase of mitosis are individual replicated chromosomes. Okay? Now, I said that we're assuming it's a diploid cell that's undergoing mitosis. Therefore, if you know it's a diploid cell, how many things line up in metaphase of mitosis? You don't know the species. How many things line up? If it's a diploid cell. Think back to mitosis. Two N things are lining up. Because it's a diploid cell, and therefore, overall, there's two N chromosomes. Right? N just means how many different one, different kinds there are. But I told you it's a diploid cell, so there are a total of 2N chromosomes. And each one is individually lining up. So there are two number ones, and there are two number twos, but the two number ones don't care what each other is doing in mitosis. Both number ones are lining up individually. They could be next to each other. They could not be next to each other. They're independently lining up. Is that clear? Okay. That's not what happens in meiosis one. Meiosis one features its own metaphase, which also involves a lining up. But it's totally different what lines up. In meiosis one metaphase, what line up are homologous pairs of chromosomes, not individual chromosomes. Okay, now homologous pair is one name that we can talk about as for something that's lining up in meiosis one metaphase. It can go by other names as well. But a homologous pair, just like we looked at in slide 2 today, is the two number ones or the two number whatevers. They're homologous to each other because they're the same kind of chromosome, right? Well, in meiosis, the two number ones come together. They find each other and come together. The two number twos find each other and come together. That doesn't happen in mitosis at all. The two number ones don't care where the other one is. Right? That coming together of homologous chromosomes in meiosis one is called synapsis. They synapse. Syn means together. So they not only find each other, they actually connect to each other temporarily. And when they are connected as a pair of homologs, as they're called, we can call that a homologous pair. I said that's one name. Some books call it a bivalent. Bivalent is another word for a synapsed pair of homologs. And another word is tetrad, which is kind of a general word meaning a four-part thing, right? A tetrad. Tetra means four. The reason that makes sense, by the way, is that we're talking about replicated chromosomes. So each of the two number ones that come together is replicated, meaning each of the two number ones is made up of two chromatids. When you get both of the number ones together, you have a total of four chromatids, and that's where the tetrad name comes from. So tetrad, bivalent, and homologous pair of chromosomes all mean the same thing for meiosis. Okay, so how many things line up in metaphase of meiosis? How many positions are there in that metaphase plate in meiosis? Right. The answer is N. 2N things line up in mitosis, N things line up, because there's pairs that line up in meiosis. Is that clear? And that makes a huge difference, because what lines up in either of these two processes determines what then splits in anaphase. So think back to mitosis again. My metaphase features a lining up of individual replicated chromosomes. For a diploid cell, there are 2N of them. And what splits in anaphase of mitosis? What separate? No? Well, yeah, it depends on how you use the words. But what actually splits apart? Before they're separate things, what are they called? That split from each other in mitosis that you're already a master of.
Sister chromatids.
sister chromatids. Yes, chromatids separate in anaphase of mitosis. And as soon as they split, we no longer call them chromatids, right? Now they are chromosomes individually, but they are unreplicated chromosomes. All right? Well, you had 26 replicated chromosomes, sorry, 2N replicated chromosomes. Now you have still, in each of those two cells, 2N unreplicated chromosomes. The ploidy has not changed, notice. Mitosis never changes the ploidy. It makes identical cells. So if you have that clear in your mind, now compare that to meiosis. What did we just say lines up in metaphase of meiosis? Homologous pairs, or bivalents, or tetrads. They all mean the same thing. And what splits then in anaphase of meiosis I is not chromatids separating from each other. Instead, the homologous pair splits into two homologs, now independent of each other. And one homolog, the one number one, let's say, is going to go to one cell, and the other number one is going to go to another cell. So realize then, therefore, that the one cell is now going to have just one of each type of chromosome, and the other one is going to have just one of each kind of chromosome. In other words, meiosis one is the part of meiosis in which the halving of the ploidy occurs. Do you see why? Let's look at this simple picture, which is actually too simple. It makes it more difficult. I wish they had used a different N. This is an N of one. Okay. The metaphase plate, by the way, is vertical in this slide. So you not only have one homologous pair, but it's lined up. Synapsis has already occurred. And this is the metaphase plate. Okay. In meiosis one, anaphase splits these two homologs from each other. One of them went to this cell, which is called a daughter cell, even though it has nothing to do with sex. The other daughter cell has the other homolog. And already, these two cells, even though they're not all the way through meiosis, they're already haploid, right? Meiosis one creates the haploidy. It divides the ploidy. Because each one of these cells already has only one of each of the one kind of chromosome. If we were talking about an N of two, let me just quickly draw it. For mitosis, an N of two, that's one replicated chromosome, would look like that, right? There's two N things lining up. Two N individual replicated chromosomes. And what splits apart are the sister chromatids. So you would end up with two cells, each having still four, but now unreplicated chromosomes. Does this make sense? Well, let's look at what 2N would look like in meiosis. You would start with two pairs of homologous chromosomes that are lined up at metaphase. So that would be, to use a horizontally placed metaphase plate again, just to compare to the mitosis I just drew, you would have one pair and the other pair. You see that? And this is the metaphase plate. So you have N things lining up, N tetrads, N homologous pairs. And now what split apart are not chromatids, but the homologs. So one cell is going to look like this, the other cell is going to look like that. I didn't use the red and blue, but I could have. All right, you see that each of these cells now is already haploid. What is N? two. It remains two. But the ploidy changes, unlike in mitosis. In mitosis, you started with an N of 2, my previous drawing. You ended with an N of 2. You started with diploid cells. You ended with diploid cells. No change. In meiosis, you started with an N of 2. You ended with an N of 2. But you started with a diploid cell, and you end up with haploid cells. Or I shouldn't even say end up with, because this is just for meiosis 1. Okay, that is really important to understand.
So after meiosis 1, then it's 2n equals n.
2n never equals n.
Yeah. So, but if
it's just that the 2n doesn't apply to these cells. It applies to only this cell.
Okay, gotcha.
Because meiosis has caused a 2n diploid cell to become n haploid cells.
That's right. Okay.
All right, now the goal, in a sense, if you want to think about it in terms of goal, the goal of meiosis is to produce cells that have half the ploidy compared to the original cell. That has already happened in meiosis 1. So why bother to have meiosis 2? Why aren't we done at this point? Well, what do you mean by that? What's the problem? What's the problem with these two cells that get created in meiosis 1? They're already haploid. Go ahead.
The gametes need to pair up two fusion with another gamete.
That has nothing to do with it. They don't have to. Most sperm go unused. Those are just dead multicellular humans. I mean, unicellular humans. And similarly, most eggs don't get used. Those are just dead unicellular humans. So, yes, the gametes can get together, but we're talking about meiosis as it occurs in one individual. Might never undergo any sexual reproduction.
So one of the cells can replace the previous cell, the other can go to the gamete?
No, that already happened. So the germline cell underwent mitosis. One of them stuck behind to replace the one that's lost. This is the other one, before at the top of the screen. These two cells have the same problem that a cell entering mitosis has. They're made up of replicated chromosomes. A replicated chromosome is enough DNA for two cells, but it's in one cell. That's why you split those two chromatids apart to create two cells out of one in mitosis, right? Well, since you didn't split chromatids apart in meiosis 1, you split homologs instead, you still have the problem of each cell having twice the amount of DNA it needs. So you need another stage that's just like mitosis to do the same thing mitosis does. Namely, to split those chromatids apart into individual cells. All right? And that happens to each of the two daughter cells of meiosis 1. So you end up, after meiosis 2, with four cells instead of two like in mitosis. Each division event doubles the number of cells because it's a splitting. All right? So one cell splits into two. Those are already haploid, which is the goal, so to speak, but they're still replicated. So you undergo another split, that makes four that are still haploid, because a mitosis-like thing, which is what meiosis 2 is like mitosis, does not change ploidy. So they remain haploid, but they are now unreplicated. They have just the amount of DNA for one cell, which they are. Okay, now that's another difference between the two. Mitosis produces two total cells, whereas meiosis produces four. But importantly, the four cells that meiosis produce are not genetically identical to each other, like the two mitosis daughter cells are. These are not genetically identical to each other, and none of them is genetically identical to the cell you started with. for multiple reasons, one of which, though, is these are all haploid cells, whereas the original cell is diploid. Of course they're not genetically identical. Is all this clear? It can be confusing when you're first learning meiosis. Compared to mitosis, it's a lot more confusing. But make sense of the fact that the ploidy division happens in meiosis 1, not in meiosis 2. Meiosis 2 simply separates chromatids so that you end up with cells having the appropriate amount of DNA, enough DNA for one cell, not for two. Okay? So if I were to draw meiosis 2 for this one, I'm drawing for n equals 2, that's n equals 1, which is confusing. It's too simple. For n equals 2, each of these then would undergo meiosis 2 to look like this. Right? Each of them still has two total chromosomes. N remains 2 throughout. You started with one diploid cell. Meiosis 1 produces two haploid cells replicated. Meiosis 2 produces 4 still haploid cells, but now unreplicated.
So meiosis 2 is more or less almost the same as just mitosis?
Yes. In fact, if you consider... We studied mitosis from the viewpoint of a diploid cell, but any kind of cell... Any kind of eukaryotic cell can undergo mitosis, a haploid cell included. We just didn't use one as an example. But if you consider haploid cell undergoing mitosis, that's really identical to meiosis 2. The only difference between meiosis 2 and mitosis in a diploid cell is simply that there's two of each of the kinds. The same exact thing is happening, though, in meiosis 2 as happens in mitosis, because the same kind of thing lines up in meiosis 2. Individual replicated chromosomes. And the same thing, therefore, splits chromatids in meiosis 2 and in mitosis. Now, 7 gives us a picture that's very similar to the picture we looked at for mitosis. I'm not going to get into it yet because we're almost out of time, but we'll talk about individual subphases next time and compare it to mitosis.